This is a continuation of the interview with Barry Virtue taking place today, the 14th of May 2012. We might begin with a song that you mentioned to me, that you performed and wrote, I believe, to mark the 75th anniversary of the Trade Commissioner's Office. Now, this was, well, when would that have been approximately?
I think it was about 2005. They arranged a lunch at the Royal Canberra Golf Club, and one of the officers in trade, who had, I think he must have heard me sing at a concert somewhere, and he said, would I come and sing a few songs at the at this lunch? One of the advantages of working for Doug Anthony was that you had the services of Margot Anthony, who was a wonderful pianist. And occasionally when I was asked to sing somewhere, Margot would play the piano for me, which was great. So we got together. We found one old song called Trade Winds. We were looking for things to do with trade. We found an old song called Trade Winds. We did that. And we did On the Road to Mandalay, you know, the old song by Kipling. And not really a trade song, but still it was all right. And I thought, well, I'll have a go at writing something. And I borrowed the tune from Arthur Sullivan. And this is the little song that I put together. I am the very model of a modern trade commissioner. With GATT and GATS and EIAs, I'm more or less familiar. With liberalisation barriers or something similar. Discriminatory measures and agreements multilateral. The World Trade Organization, the Doha Round, Cancun collapse. After EFIC, export subsidies, harmonisation. And then there is that friend of ours, the old most favoured nation. But what's this controversial thing that's called globalization? The minister is coming through. What can we find for him to do? Free trade and tariff cuts might serve to help him make a speech or two. I hope he'll tell my Austrade boss that I'm a good practitioner, for I'm the very model of a modern trade commissioner. Thank you very much.
Very
Thank
good.
You. Thank
very
you.
Very good. Very clever.
I put in all the trade type terms that I could remember from many years earlier.
Yeah, well done. Yeah.
Yes.
And how did it go down?
It seemed to go down pretty well. In fact, a former secretary of the department rang me up afterwards to say how much he enjoyed it. So that was nice.
Good.
That was nice.
All right, well, thanks for that. And now, shall we proceed from where we left last time? I was actually going to ask you last time about lobbyists. Were there lobbyists contacting Mr. Anthony's office in your time? And if there were, where would meetings with them take place?
Well, yes, well, there were lobbyists, not to nearly the extent that I understand exists today. but there were some lobbyists. I think the people that wanted to see him were mainly from the industry organisations, you know, the Farmers Federation, or whatever it was called in those days, and the Mining Industry Council and so on. I don't think there was so much of other types of lobbying, if I put it that way. They would, just like anybody else, they would make an appointment and come and see him in his office here at Parliament House.
Can we talk now about Mr. Anthony himself, Doug Anthony? You know, we know what his contribution to Parliament was because the Hansard records his speeches and so on. But I'm wondering about him as a person, like his character and personality and intellect, grasp of politics.
I remember once somebody wrote an article, I think they were called profile pieces, in the Sydney Morning Herald. It might have been Peter Bowers. And he asked Doug, it was probably when he became Minister for Primary Industry or leader of the party or something like that, but he asked Doug how he would rank himself in these areas that you were talking about. And I remember Doug said he thought he was FAQ, which is a wheat growers term for fair average quality, you know, well known to people in the wheat industry. And that was how he regarded himself. And I think that was pretty right. You know, what you saw was what you got. People knew he was relaxed, laid back. That was the impression they got of him. And that was what he was like. You know, he was a terrific fellow to work for. You were treated like one of the family. And it was really a wonderful experience, you know, the time that I spent with him.
Can you provide examples of how, you know, you say he was great to work with and part of the family?
Well, we spent a lot of time at his house in Hughes, where they lived there, and I was quite often at his home in Mooloolambah, at Sunny Meadows on the farm. They had a little beach house at New Brighton, which is a little place just north of Brunswick Heads. And each Christmas, when Doug was running the country, so to speak, while the PM was on holidays, we would set up an office in an old caravan that we used to hire and have it beside the beach house. And my in-laws lived at Bangalow, and of course we would go up, and my parents, when they were alive, lived at Bexhill, which is not far from Lismore. And we would go up there during the holidays, but each day I would drive down to New Brighton and look after this little office. And we had it set up with a phone and a fax machine in those days. And, you know, there was a lot of paperwork coming through all the time, and sometimes officers coming up from Canberra to see him and bring stuff up. So it was quite busy. I tell people, I like to think I was running the country while Doug was off fishing, but that wasn't strictly accurate, of course, but there was a little bit of a little bit of truth in it. But no, of course, he was in charge of things. I remember we'd go to, well, we went to thousands, I suppose, of meetings of all different kinds, all around the country, in country areas usually, farmers' meetings or political meetings or party meetings, whatever they were. And it always struck me that, and I thought it was a sign of the kind of person he was, that he never once in all those years that I was with him expressed the view. For example, we'd be at a meeting, he would have been talking all day at meetings of various kinds. There'd be a dinner or something, then another meeting at night time, and the time would be getting on and people would want to talk to him, and he'd stand there and he'd talk and he'd talk and he'd talk. And I used to get sick to death of it, and I thought, you know, can't we go and get into bed somewhere? When we finally left and got in the car, he never once said, well, thank goodness that's over. I would have said that. That's the way I felt. And I think that demonstrated what a genuine sort of person he was. He, if I had to try to think of a word that, one word that would sort of sum him up, it would be loyalty. He was very loyal to people. He was loyal to his staff. He was loyal to his colleagues. I remember when Peter Nixon got into some strife, I think it was about milk products or meat exports or something like that. Ian Sinclair got into some trouble at one stage. Doug ferociously defended them. He defended a succession of Liberal prime ministers that he served under. When Philip Lynch, I think when he was Treasurer, he got into some difficulty about financial matters. Doug went to see him in Melbourne. I don't know whether any others did. They might have, but Doug certainly made a point of going to see Philip Lynch. There was a journalist named Ron Anderson who produced I think it was a weekly or a monthly newsletter for the primary industries. And Doug had something to do with him in that area. And when he heard that Ron Anderson was dying of cancer, he went to his home in Melbourne to see him. And I, you know, they're the sort of things that I think showed what kind of person he was.
Is there anything else in addition to loyalty as far as character goes?
I'm not quite sure how to put it all. But there was the genuineness, which I think I've already talked about. I'll have to think about that one. Let's come back to that one, and I'll sort of have a bit of a think in the meantime.
And what about intellect? Was he an intellectual type of person?
Well, that's a hard question to ask me, Barry. he described himself as FAQ, and I think what he had was common sense. He was very big on common sense. And as Malcolm Fraser said once, it goes back to the loyalty thing, he said, Doug Anthony was a very good bloke to have on your side in a fight. Mm. And I think that sums him up.
What about his grasp of politics and effectiveness as a member and minister? Are you able to comment on that?
Well, I think he had an enormous grasp of politics because he grew up in a political environment. As you, I'm sure you know, his father was a minister in the Menzies government. Doug started coming to Canberra when he was seven, and his father was a minister. And he told me once he had a very warm memories of John Curtin, who of course was a Labor Prime Minister, because he said when they lived at the old Kurrajong Hotel when he was a little kid, he said every night after dinner, Curtin would sit down on the lounge with him and tell him a bedtime story. And he always remembered that, and that, you know, he felt, had a warm feeling towards Curtin. But I think, you know, he did have a very good grasp of politics. He had a knack of, if difficulties arose within his party or anywhere else, he had a knack of sort of dealing with them. I remember once there was some problem arose regarding one of his colleagues. I can't think what it was now. But that night the colleague found himself out at the house at Kent Street having dinner with the family. Quite often overseas ministers, trade ministers or others were visiting Australia, he would invite them home to have dinner with the family. And little personal touches like that, I think, made a big difference.
Good, thanks for that, yes. I'm wondering whether he ever... first of all, how did you address him in the office?
Before I came to work for him, I knew him because I was a reporter on the newspaper at Lismore, the Northern Star, and Doug would call in occasionally. And I, like everybody else, I called him Doug. And when I came to work for him, I said, what should I call you? He said, well, you better call me Minister in public. He said, but you can call me whatever you like in private. I don't think I called him anything, to tell you the truth.
Did he ever speak with you about McMahon's refusal to let him know the date of the election in 1970?
Yeah. Oh, yes, he did. That was a very strange thing, you know. But McMahon was a strange person. But no, Doug, as I recall it, Doug went along to ask McMahon what the date of the 1972 election would be, because Doug needed to start getting his party ready for it. And it's an enormous task, of course, the logistics and everything else of organising an election campaign, writing policy speeches and all that sort of thing. And as I recall, Doug said that when he asked Sir William about the date of the election, Sir William said something like, there are only three people who need to know what the date is and you're not one of them. Which I thought was an astonishing thing for a Prime Minister to say to a Deputy Prime Minister. And Doug told me that he thought, Billy will know himself. Perhaps the other one is Sonia, Mrs. McMahon, Lady McMahon. And the third one he thought of would be the Prime Minister of New Zealand, Sir John Marshall, because in those days Australia and New Zealand were in the habit of holding their elections on the same day. So he told me that he rang Marshall, who knew, and he said, oh, good day, Jack. He said, when is your election on? And Marshall said, what, hasn't he told you yet? And Doug said, no. And anyway, Marshall told him when the date of the election was, which I think said a lot about both, it said things about Anthony, but it said a lot more about McMahon. Mm. Yeah. One of the other things that showed what a down-to-earth sort of bloke he was, I don't know whether I mentioned this to you. When I first arrived here in 1964, and he was living out at Hughes, he used to ride a bike into work every day. And he bought a folding bicycle, and one that had come to bits. And he'd ride the bike in, and then at night when he was going home, he'd fold the bike up and put it in the boot of the car, and the Commonwealth car, and take it home. It was interesting. Three or four days after we got here, Doug invited Claire, my wife, to come over to have morning tea here to meet the other members of the staff. Three of them there were in those days. There were four of us all together. And so I think Claire must have dropped me over here and went home again. And then was driving over later on, and she wasn't terribly familiar with Canberra. And she found herself going around State Circle twice. And she said each time she went around, she overtook Doug on his bike. I said, why didn't you stop and ask him the way to be? She said, I was too shy to stop and talk to him. I'll tell you these little stories. On one occasion, when he was acting PM, when Malcolm Fraser was in hospital in Melbourne, Fraser, I think, used to have trouble with his back, and he spent a bit of time in hospital. And one day, Doug and Sir Geoffrey Yean, who was secretary of PM and C at that time, they called into the hospital to see him. And Doug said that while the media people were waiting outside the hospital to find out what great matters of state had been discussed, he and Geoff Yean and Malcolm Fraser were watching Yes Minister on the television. He said the interesting thing was they all laughed at different parts of it. He acted as Prime Minister on 26 occasions that I recall. Well, I don't recall, but we've got a note of it. I looked it up. And some of them were for quite long periods. Some of them were several months when Fraser was off sick, I know. And talking about people being off sick, Doug himself was off sick on one occasion for several months. He got sick in Russia. He'd been to, I forget where he'd been before, one of the Middle Eastern countries. Then he went to Russia and he got very sick. And the Russians did all sorts of tests and so on, and he came home. It was a hepatitis-like thing, but nobody seemed to know what it was. And doctors here couldn't work it out. In the end, I got onto the Russian embassy and asked if they could get the results of the tests they'd done in Moscow sent out to us, which they did. And we gave them to the doctors here, and they finally worked out what it was. But he was very sick for months and months and months. And for the whole of that time, there was no suggestion whatever that anybody else would become leader of the party. They were just prepared to wait till he came back. It was that kind of a party. Yeah.
Are there any other points here from your notes?
In the, I mentioned earlier the caravan that we used to have at New Brighton. I don't know whether it's still there. I haven't looked, but in the old Country Party, National Party room here at Old Parliament House,
pardon me,
there was a photograph on the wall taken inside the caravan at New Brighton, and the young bloke in it with the beard is me. But there's nothing on it to say that it's me. It says that it's Doug Anthony and so on. I've complained to Doug about that. I said, you were chairman of the old Parliament House Governing Council for 10 years. You should have been able to get that fixed. But now he's no longer the chairman. I suppose this grave historical deficiency will never be remedied.
Okay, I'll take a note.
All right, yeah. You might be able to get it fixed. I don't know whether that picture's still there. I haven't had a look.
Well, I'll check it out.
Yeah.
And so you're the young fellow with the beard.
Yes, yes. The only other person in the picture, so you wouldn't miss me. I brought my little granddaughter here one day, one of my granddaughters when she was 4 or 5, I think. And each place we went where I used to work, I said, there should be a plaque on the wall that says, Grandpa used to sit here.
Now, you were in the service of Doug Anthony during a period when there were 8 prime ministers. Did you have any or much contact with them individually? Did you get to
not a lot. Any of them? Not a lot. Menzies was the prime minister when I arrived, and I really know more than he used to use the back entrance to the prime minister's office. I used to see him walking in there each morning coming to work. Then Holt became Prime Minister. Wasn't much contact with Holt. I remember Holt gave us a lift to Brisbane once on his plane. He was going somewhere. But I can't say there was any personal contact. McEwen, of course, I had more contact with because he was leader of the party when I arrived. He's a very tough character, McEwen. He had a terrific relationship, as I understood it, with his staff, certainly, and with the officials in his department. But at the same time, he could be very hard on them. A former senior official, he was at the Bureau of Agricultural Economics, but he's now a professor at the ANU. But he told me that he wrote a speech for McEwen once and brought it over and McEwen read it and ripped it up and threw it in the bin. Well, you don't do that to senior public servants, I don't think. And this public servant said, we took it back to the department and we changed one word in it and we printed it out again and brought it back over, and McEwen said he was quite happy with it. It was good. He can be very difficult, very, very tough on his, on people like that. Gorton, well, he struck me as a bit of a larrikin. I don't think he was, you know. I remember once the phone rang in the office, and John Christian, who was the departmental representative at the time, he answered the phone and he said, oh, I'll put Mr. Virtue on Prime Minister. And I thought, what's the Prime Minister want? Anyway, it was Gorton. It was the time we were trying to export merino rams. The government had decided that it was a good idea to export merino rams to try to lift the quality of wool production all around the world. They thought that would be a good thing for the whole international wool industry, including our own. But the unions thought that we were giving away our wool heritage and so on, and they bitterly opposed this plan to export the merinos. And I remember a charter flight came in, and I think he landed at Coffs Harbour or somewhere like that, and he was to pick up this merino ram and take it somewhere. And Gorton was ringing up about that. He used to sort of involve himself in the little details like that. And he wouldn't know, you know, what's happening? Why hasn't the plane left, you know, so on. I said, well, I think they've got the ram on board, but the weather is too bad for them to take off. And that was just a little passing contact I had with Gorton. The day that Holt disappeared, McEwen's office rang me at home in Garran. I lived then. We lived then, and said that McEwen wanted Anthony back in Canberra as soon as possible. He was in Woolloombar somewhere. I tracked him down at his brother's house, Bob's house at Hastings Point up near Tweed Heads, and McEwen's people had already arranged for a VIP aircraft to be sent to Coolangatta to pick him up. I met him at the RAF base about 9 o'clock that night when he arrived. And he said, oh, we'll go to the Currajong. He wanted to see McEwen. McEwen lived there. And he said, I just waited in the car, of course, and he went in, and he wasn't there long, and he came out. He said, I think I'll go and see John Gorton. So we drove up to Narrabunda, to Gorton's house, and Doug said, oh, you might as well go home. He said, I'll get myself home later. But just as he was walking up the path, I heard him say, are you there, John? And Gorton said, is that you, Doug? That was all I heard, but a couple of days later, Gorton was the Prime Minister. And McEwen, in their discussions at the Currajong, had sort of given Anthony the job of persuading Gorton that he should be the next Prime Minister. And it's interesting, Doug said that he got the impression that Gorton hadn't even thought of that. Of course, Holt had only disappeared that day, but things do move very, very quickly in politics when things like that happen. But Doug said he went through with Gorton, the idea of getting him out of the Senate and into Holt's seat at the by-election that would be held if Holt wasn't found. But he said he had the feeling that Gorton hadn't thought about any of that. But anyway, very soon afterwards, Gorton was the Prime Minister.
Well, you mentioned the word larrikin in regards to Gorton. In what ways was he a larrikin?
It's hard to sort of put the finger on it. The fact that he rang up when he was talking about the sheep that day, it was sort of a... It didn't seem like a prime minister that I was talking to. And there was, of course, there were various things that happened that are on the public record that sort of portrayed him a little bit in that light.
Yep. Certainly other interviewees who have worked with him have confirmed that.
I'm sure they would. We were talking about McMahon earlier and the election date business. At the release of the cabinet papers under the 30-year rule a few years ago, I can't remember which year it was, they asked Doug to come and speak at it, as they do, you know, each year. And I remember Ian, what's his name, a historian fellow?
Hancock.
Ian Hancock. Ian Hancock described McMahon as cabinet serial leaker at that when they released those papers, and I think that was probably right. I remember the day it was some hullabaloo was going on in the house regarding Gorton, and he said something or other, and Alan Ramsey from the Australian newspaper shouted, "You liar!" from the press gallery, which was fairly dramatic.
Were you in the vicinity?
I was standing in the press gallery.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember Tony Eggleton, who was working for Gorton, of course, at that time. He got up and wandered out, and a few minutes later he came in and passed a note to somebody or other, but Ramsey had apologised for what he said, which just as well, too. It could have caused a lot of trouble if he hadn't.
How did you react when that happened?
I recall he didn't react at all. He just ignored it.
But you personally? Me personally? There in the press gallery.
I was just shocked, you know, that anybody would do it, because it seemed to me to be a most unusual and dangerous thing for a journalist standing in the press gallery to interject, you know, in a loud voice. I was shocked.
Did other journalists in the gallery feel that way?
I can't remember. I just can't remember
what
happened about that. The thing that I remember about Whitlam, Whitlam struck me as an arrogant sort of fellow and all that. But there's one incident that sort of upset me at the time. He was speaking at this is when we were in opposition, of course, and he was Prime Minister, and he was speaking at some function in South Australia. And he said that he didn't have any association with CIA money like Anthony does, or Anthony did, worse than that. If it were, I don't have any association with CIA money like Anthony does. And Brian Toohey, who worked with the Financial Review at that time, rang me up and said, you know, what do you say about this? I said, I've got no idea what he's talking about. And I rang Doug, he was in Mwillimbar, I think, and he said, I've got no idea what he's talking about, don't know what it means. It turned out that I think it was 9 years earlier, Doug had decided to let his house at Hughes over the Christmas holiday period. Pardon me. And he put it in the hands of a real estate agent, and the estate agent let the house to the American Embassy. And the American Embassy put a fellow into it with his family, who it turned out was a CIA person. Well, Doug didn't know, you know, nobody knew. And I think the real estate agent was, in fact, a friend of mine and lived just across the street from us. And he brought over the rent statement, which, and I think it was something like $570, was the total amount of rent that Doug had received for this house over a period of several months. He thought it might be useful, this fellow.
That
was the basis of Whitlam saying that Anthony had this association with CIA money. Well, I sort of regarded that as a dreadful thing to say.
Did you meet Whitlam personally at
no,
all?
No, no. Oh, I just said good day to him a couple of times, you know, that's all. But no. Fraser was a very demanding fellow. I think that's well known. He would demand this and this and this. He wanted things done and all this work would be done, and then he never really did anything with it, was the understanding that I had. I was talking one day to, I think it was Alan Barnes, pardon me, who was a journalist with, no, it couldn't have been Alan Barnes because it was the Melbourne Herald we were talking about. Alan Barnes was with The Age. Forget who it was. But for some reason, I forget how it came up, but I said, of course, you know, working in a coalition is difficult, which I thought was an obvious common-sense thing to say. And this fellow wrote a story in which he quoted me as saying that. Well, the next thing, I had Malcolm Fraser on the phone. He said, why did you say that? I said, well, it is difficult. And he went crook. He said, well, you better try and fix it up. So I went and saw the journalist, whoever it was. I forget now who it was. And I said, oh, I'm in trouble, Vic. You know, Fraser was upset about this. So he very kindly pulled it out of the next edition of the newspaper, or the remaining editions, which I thought was a very good thing for him to do, just to help me out of a little spot.
Yeah.
And I mentioned this to Doug sometime, and my understanding is he rang Fraser and said, have you got anything to say, say it to him, not to me or anybody else, say it to him, which was another example of his loyalty and his support. Bob Hawke, I always thought it was interesting. I thought he adapted very quickly to being Prime Minister. You know, he'd come in from the union movement, but he sort of got the hang of how the place worked very quickly. The thing I remember most is that I think it was during what was known as the David Coombe affair. Yeah. Something to do with David Coombe and an official from the Russian embassy, and it went on and on and on. And I was writing a speech for Doug to make in a debate on this matter, and I came up with a line, because Hawke would come in every day to the House and be questioned about this, and he would go on and on and on, you know. So there was to be an urgency motion or something. So I wrote some lines for which Doug was to say at the beginning. "Mr. Speaker, the Prime Minister comes clanking into this House every day, his loins girt about with truth, wearing the breastplate of righteousness and the helmet of integrity, carrying the shield of veracity, and holding high the sword of probity." I pinched these words, obviously, from the biblical passage, which uses words like that, and I sort of elaborated on them a bit. But I couldn't think what to say next. And Liam Bathgate, who was Doug's press secretary at the time, he suggested that Doug then say, "But yesterday his pants fell down," which I wouldn't have said, but it worked very well. And Hawke enjoyed it, and Pryor drew a cartoon of it. So that's my main memory of Hawke.
Yeah, nice cartoon.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it is. Very. Yeah, Pryor was very good at that sort of thing.
Did you have much to do with Hawke, though, personally?
No, not really. I saw Hawke, I think, only once after I left politics. I was working at the Law Council, and I was at a conference in Melbourne of an organisation called Law Asia, I think it was, and Bob Hawke came along to speak at it, and I had a few words with him then, but that was all, you know, it was just passing contact. I think that's all the Prime Ministers that I sort of was involved with.
And what about former Prime Ministers, like Chifley or...?
No, well, when did Chifley die?
50, I think it was.
Yeah, well, see, I didn't come until 64.
Yeah,
so no, I didn't really know any former Prime Ministers. Except Earl Page. Well, no, I didn't know him at all. Earl Page, but he was still around, of course, long before I came down here. I think my wife, she was the secretary to the town clerk of Lismore City Council, and she remembers Earl Page coming there. Oh, you know, yes. I think that was when he was Prime Minister, to see the town clerk.
Political events that stand out in your mind to do with the old Parliament House?
Well, the obvious one is the dismissal. Mm-hmm. although we didn't... Doug was extremely circumspect, always. You know, I mentioned that Ian Hancock said that McMahon was Cabinet's serial leaker. As far as I know, Doug never leaked anything from Cabinet. He didn't even talk to his staff about it. And I think a lot of ministers did. Which is fair enough, but Doug was very, very careful, and all the time the dismissal build-up was coming, he didn't really talk to us about it. He would go and talk to Fraser a lot and all that sort of thing, and I've read since in the book that Paul Davey wrote about the Anthony family, he has some references there, the things Doug told him about things that were happening during that period, about meetings they had with Whitlam and Lance Barnard and Fred Daly was at a meeting. I didn't know anything about that. I didn't realise that meeting had taken place because he, as I said, he was very careful what he said and didn't talk about these things. So I can't really, apart from the dismissal, which everybody knows about, the way I found out about what had happened was that he'd been around talking to Fraser or someone, and he came back and he said, "Well, the Governor-General has sacked the Prime Minister." That was it. But he hadn't discussed anything before that.
Now, how did you react to that when he came and told you that?
Well, I was a bit shocked, like everybody else. And it Well, as you know, it was a very strange day, a frightening day, really. You know, huge crowds of people gathered outside Parliament House here, and there was a terrible, feeling of fury and so on. And I remember they were collecting, I don't know whether that was that day or later, but they were collecting money in buckets from people who, to help the Labor Party. And Gough made his famous statement about nothing will save the Governor-General. But of course, eventually, the government was swept out of office in a landslide, a huge landslide, which suggests that the people agreed that it should go.
Any other events here at Old Parliament House that you'd like to refer to? Political or other, like visiting dignitaries or that kind of thing as well?
I just can't think of anything specific that I could talk about. I was thinking in the car this morning coming in, there was just a little incident, just a very minor thing. It must have been the week or a couple of weeks after I got here. There was in those days, before local government in Canberra, there was an ACT advisory council, and one of the members of it was a Mrs. Dalgano. And I remember when I arrived, there was this controversy going on that somebody wanted to build a service station at Griffith, in the suburb of Griffith, near the Griffith shops. And Mrs. Dalgano, I remember, she said, "They'll build it over my dead body." And I remember all this because she came to see Doug and gave him a blast about it.